From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Bette Midler. She'll tell us how community theater in Hawaii prepared her for the gay baths in New York, where she launched her solo career and created her alter ego, the Divine Miss M. Her new CD, Bathhouse Betty, features songs that remind her of the songs she performed at the baths. And Maureen Corrigan reviews The Hours, Michael Cunningham's novel inspired by Virginia Woolf's novel, Mrs. Dalloway. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. House Republicans have selected Louisiana Congressman Bob Livingston as their choice to succeed Newt Gingrich as Speaker. Given the GOP's control of the House, he's assured of election to the job when the new session begins in January. Republican lawmakers are now considering the other leadership positions. The White House is criticizing the limits being placed on the questioning of independent counsel Kenneth Starr when he testifies before the House Judiciary Committee starting tomorrow. Chairman Henry Hyde cut a request by White House counsel Charles Ruff for 90 minutes of questioning time down to 30 minutes. White House Press Secretary Joe Lockhart says that is not enough time. President Clinton has left Washington for a six-day trip to Asia with stops in Japan, South Korea, and Guam. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from Tokyo.
President Clinton's first stop is Tokyo, where he will meet with Japanese officials and hold a televised town meeting with Japanese citizens to discuss ways Japan can make the economic reforms the U.S. believes will help bring it out of its long recession.
Nothing is more important to restoring stability and growth in Asia than efforts to restart Japan's economy. It has long been Asia's engine of growth. It is, as all of us know, the second largest economy in the world. But it has been stalled for 5 years.
So far, the U.S. has been frustrated with Japanese efforts. One top Treasury official told NPR that the latest Japanese stimulus package was not enough to get the economy going again. And earlier this week, the U.S. failed to get Japan to agree to a market-opening trade agreement. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Tokyo.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair says opposition to Iraqi President Saddam Hussein is growing. He made the remarks after announcing that Britain will now join the United States in increasing efforts to bring about a change of government in Iraq. NPR's Jennifer Lutton reports from London.
In an interview with the New York Times, Prime Minister Blair says he has evidence that Saddam Hussein is vulnerable. He says Iraqis are concerned at the incredible damage the president is doing to his own country. The American CIA has hatched numerous plans in recent years to overthrow Saddam Hussein, but they failed amid infighting within the Iraqi opposition. British security services have helped a London-based Iraqi opposition group with its propaganda campaign, but the public decision to join U.S. efforts to remove the Iraqi president is a marked shift. Blair has dismissed theories that Saddam Hussein wanted to be attacked to boost his standing among Arabs. In the face of action, he tells the New York Times, he completely crumpled. I'm Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, London.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 11 points at 8,976 in moderate trading. And on the NASDAQ, the composite index is down a fraction of a point. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, stock prices are sagging somewhat today despite the Federal Reserve's decision yesterday to cut short-term interest rates once again. NPR's Jack Spear has more.
One day after the Federal Reserve Board's powerful Open Market Committee trimmed the interest rates that it controls by a quarter of a point, Wall Street isn't showing a whole lot of enthusiasm. Why no big bounce from this latest rate cut? The analysts, as usual, are somewhat divided, though amid signs of some stability and with only one more scheduled Fed meeting on tap in 1998, the market may be ruling out any further rate cutting this year. Wall Street also may have already factored in the latest cut since it was widely anticipated. Meantime, there was one piece of new economic news out today. The Commerce Department reported the nation's trade gap fell in September to just over $14 billion. The $2 billion decrease was mostly the result of increased shipments of U.S.-built airplanes overseas. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
A delegation from the International Monetary Fund has arrived in Moscow for new talks with Russian government officials on a plan for addressing the country's economic crisis. A key item on the agenda is reportedly a restructuring of the $4.6 billion in Russian debt to the IMF, which is due next year. Bausch & Lomb says it may sell its eyewear business in order to concentrate on its healthcare division. The company is considering a joint venture, sale, or spin-off as it explores strategic options for the unit, which includes the Ray-Ban sunglass line. Campbell Soup served up a good earnings report this morning. The company's results matched Wall Street estimates, marking an improvement from the same quarter a year ago. Still, the company says a gain in sales was somewhat offset by fluctuations in foreign currency values. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bette Midler has a new album called Bathhouse Betty, which features songs that remind her of the one she sang early in her career when she used to perform in a gay bathhouse in New York. The album also includes the song My One True Friend, which she recorded for the movie One True Thing, the Ben Folds song Boxing, and a rap inspired by her hairdresser called I'm Beautiful. Bette Midler started her recording career in 1972 and started her movie career with the 1979 film The Rose. Her other movies include Down and Out in Beverly Hills, Beaches, Scenes from a Mall, and The First Wives Club. Before we meet her, let's hear a song from Bathhouse Betty. This is Ukulele Lady. Ukulele Lady from Bette Midler's new CD, Bathhouse Betty. Bette Midler, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Since we just heard a Hawaii-themed song, let's talk about your early days growing up in Hawaii. Would you describe the neighborhood you grew up in?
Well, you know what it was? It was a series of old barracks that had been used in to house soldiers in the Second World War, and it had been converted to civilian housing. And it was... they were some of the apartments were one story. They were all wooden, and they had paper walls, walls that were made actually of pressed cane. It was called canic, and you could sort of hear everything. You know, the walls didn't keep any sound out, and the neighborhood was plopped right in the middle of the cane fields. So there were cane fields all around. The dirt is very, very red. The sun is very bright. The sky is very blue. The sunsets were magnificent. The house itself was not anything to talk about, but the physical environment of the sky and the sea and the dirt and the green and the brilliance of the flowers, that really was astonishing.
Why and when did your parents move to Hawaii?
My father went to Hawaii when he was in the service in the 30s, and he liked it a lot, and he came back to New Jersey where he was from and married my mom, and they went out before the Second World War. And in fact, my mother was pregnant with my sister, my oldest sister, when Pearl Harbor happened. And they stayed through the war, and they only returned to New Jersey in the very early 50s. And I think they realized they didn't care for it anymore. They were happier in Hawaii, and they went back, and that's where they lived out their days.
You know, you always seemed so New York to me that when I learned that you were from Hawaii, I thought, no, that can't be.
Well, my parents actually made New York seem like the promised land. They talked a lot about it. They laughed about it. Their eyes lit up when they recalled their own childhoods in the East. And we all wanted to go there. my whole family, my sisters and I, we all wanted to go there. We thought, gosh, that must be so exciting. And in the end, we all did. As soon as my two sisters got out of college, they went, and I didn't spend very much time in college. I only spent about a year, and I came too, and I was instantly at home. So maybe all that talk about about it was helpful.
Well, before you got to New York, did you feel at all like you were in the wrong place as, a member of a Jewish family who was originally from New Jersey?
Well, I did and I didn't. I did because we were the only white people in our neighborhood. White people are called Howleys, and they don't distinguish between people who are Jewish and people who are Christians. They don't even care. They don't care what religion you are. You're white. That's that. So we were a Howley family in the midst of a Polynesian and mixed Polynesian community. And in one way, I did feel quite like the outsider, because I was very interested. I love to read. I love to look at, to think about the theater. I loved the idea of show business. I loved all those things. And yet this environment, the natural environment, was so extraordinary that I was completely at home. I used to watch the grass grow. I would lay down and watch the grass grow and talk to the ants and count the rocks and look at the sky and see the animals floating across the sky. And I was in heaven. I was completely in heaven, as long as I didn't have to go and be a Howley amongst this other community.
But you did, didn't you? I mean, you...
Yes, I did. So there was one part of this life was very, very unsettled and very uncomfortable. And yet the other part of it, when I was in nature, I was completely happy and completely at home.
So you were one with nature, but an outsider among people.
Exactly.
Did you have a flair for theater as a kid, for the theatrical? Did you dress theatrically or have big gestures or, see life as theater?
Well, I did. Actually, I did. By the time I was in the sixth grade, I was calling people darling. I mean, I don't know I don't know where that came from. I really don't know where it came from. I spent a lot of time in the library. My parents used to park us at the public library, a huge building, at least I thought it was huge, in the middle of Honolulu, which is an extremely charming town with beautiful sort of Pacific Northwest architecture, lots of stone buildings with beautiful tile roofs. And my parents used to park us in either at the Y or at the public library at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they would come and get us at 4 every weekend of our lives for at least 10 years. So I used to wander the halls of the library, and I found the theater section when I was very young. And I would go and I would play records in the theater section. I would play shows, and I would look at magazines, and I would look at books on ballerinas and shows that they had done in New York. I was a little kid, so everything that I picked up had an enormous impact on me. And I wasn't sports-minded at all, although I have discovered very late in life that I am exceptionally strong. But I never got picked for any of the teams. And the big thing in our world was volleyball and softball and baseball. And my community was very sports-oriented, and I wasn't very sports-minded. I was a bookworm.
It's interesting that the library played such a big part in interesting you in theater. I think you didn't get a telephone or a television until you were a teenager.
Just about. That's just about right. I was old. I was much older. I was something like 11 or 12. And consequently, I don't have the TV habit that people my age have. I'm not used to turning it on. I remember very vividly when we were children, we came to New Jersey and people had TVs, and it was a very big thing, and I didn't get it. I mean, I watched what was on it, and I didn't get it. I didn't understand the charm of what was on it, and I didn't know why anyone would sit and watch it. So I never really got the habit, even though eventually when I became a teenager, to see Elvis Presley was a joy. To see the Ed Sullivan Show was a joy. And those things I did get addicted to, but the general tenor of TV never got it.
Bette Midler's my guest. I want to play another track from your new CD, Bath House Betty. And this is I Sold My Heart to the Junk Man. You mentioned that you heard a lot of Broadway music in the library. Did you hear rhythm and blues or rock and roll when you were in Hawaii?
I remember very vividly when the first rock and roll song I ever heard, it was in the middle 50s, I think it was 55 or 56, and it was Ape Call. That was one. And then there was the one about the car. It was Nervous Norvis, I think, was making records, and Little Richard was making records. And those acts used to come to Hawaii. We had a terrific promoter there, and they all came through Hawaii. And I knew kids in the fifth and sixth grade who actually did get to go. I didn't get to go because I couldn't afford it. But the radio, there were a couple of really, really good radio stations there. And we heard it. And it was very, very exciting to us. Rhythm and blues I came to actually late in life, relatively late in life. When I came to New York, I met a couple of people who were just stone, hardcore rhythm and blues fanatics. And they started, we used to go home after our work and they would play these records for me. And I was completely carried away by it. And it still remains my first love. When I think about pop music. I do love pop music, but my soul absolutely is stuck in rhythm and blues. And I should not forget that I'm also a Hawaiian music fanatic, which is something that people don't really know about me. I'm attached to that music in a very visceral way. I guess because we had a hula teacher kind of close to our house, and my mom sent me to hula class for a couple of years. And I mean, I really didn't get the dancing. I wasn't particularly good at the dancing. But boy, did I love that music. See, Hawaiian music, there's a lot of yodeling in it. And I always used to say that the men sing high and the women sing low. That's not necessarily true. But the group of performers that I was brought up with were exceptional musicians. And that's one of the great joys of being in that part of the world. People love to sing, and they love to dance, and they love to have a good time.
Would you do some Hawaiian vocalization or sing a little bit of a Hawaiian song for us?
Oh. Ulili'e, ulili'ho'e, ulili'holo'holo'kaka'i'e, huia'ka'u'alana'mali'e. That's a very popular song. But there are others. I in the back of my mind, I've always thought, oh, one of these days I'm going to make a Hawaiian album. But I don't think I'm going to get around to it at the rate I'm going. I only make a record once every couple of years or so.
Well, in the meantime, let's hear a track from your new CD. And this is I Sold My Heart to the Junk Man from Bette Midler's new CD, Bath House Betty.
I gave my heart to you, the one that I trusted. You brought it back to me, all broken and busted. So I sold my heart to the junk man, and I'll never fall in love again. You took my heart because you thought you could use it, just like a little toy. You battered and bruised it, so I sold my heart to the junk man.
Bette Midler from her new CD, Bath House Betty. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bette Midler. She has a new CD called Bath House Betty. So you were telling us how you really wanted to get to New York when you were younger. And, of course, you finally did. I guess you were, what, in your late teens?
I was 19 years old, just a couple of months shy of being 20.
And you felt like you had come home when you got there?
Basically, yes.
But there must have been stuff there that was so alien to you.
No, nothing. I fell right into it. I had no problem. Everything seemed just perfectly normal. The racket, the noise, the carry on, people carrying on, the speed. It just seemed right. It all seemed right. Subsequently, I left for L.A. In the 70s because I wanted to very badly to get started on a film career, and I actually really kind of liked L.A. too. I liked the quiet. It was deadly. It was like being in a tomb. And after all those years of racket in New York, I kind of really, really enjoyed that too.
One of your big breaks when you came to New York was that you were, I think, first cast in the chorus of Fiddler on the Roof on Broadway, and then became one of the daughters in it. Which songs did you get to sing in Fiddler?
I sang Matchmaker, and I sang, I think that's the only song I had a solo in. In the chorus, I sang Frumacera's part one time. That was a great song. How can you allow it? How can you let your daughter take my place? I always loved that, and I loved the costume. What a costume. That was a fabulous, fabulous score.
What did you learn about music and theater from the theater people who you hung out with while doing Fiddler on the Roof?
Well, actually, to tell you the truth, I learned more when I was in Hawaii in the community theater, because they are very actory in community theater. They're, you know, I guess because it's not a professional environment, the idea that people from the community come and are stars in these plays, you get the most flamboyant people in the entire community. So that our community theater was a hotbed of the most flamboyant types you could possibly imagine. And so I was, in fact, when I got to New York, I was kind of let down because we had real peacocks in our community theater, and they were definitely peahens in New York. They weren't as in love with it as they were in Hawaii. They were really swept up, carried away by show business in Hawaii, and not so much, really, when I got to New York.
Now, how did you end up from Fiddler on the Roof to singing in the baths to an audience of gay men?
Well, I worked in the Fiddler on the Roof for 3 years, and I was determined to get another job in another show because I wanted the experience of other shows and playing other parts, of course, but I couldn't get another job. I was I went to auditions, and I had my 8x10s, and I had all my songs, you know, and I was prepared. And I got called back many, many times, but I never actually got another job. And I finally said, well, gee, I don't get this. This isn't really happening for me. And there was something else going on at the same time. It was the 60s, and there was madness in the streets, and music had completely turned over on its head. The Beatles and the Stones and rock and roll was crazy. And it seemed like the people that were my age, something was happening to them, and I wanted to be part of that. And it seemed like I couldn't be part of that in the theater. And so I looked around, and I was very lucky because there was a girl who was in the show with me, and she said, oh, come on down to come downtown with me. We're singing. Everyone's going to sing a few songs in this club. So I said, well, sure. And I got my little bag with my little songs, and I went down with her, and I sang. I'll never forget it. I sat. The guy who played for that crowd of people was a brilliant, brilliant guy. His sight reading was impeccable. He could change a key whenever you wanted. And I sat down and I sang God Bless the Child. And something happened to me when I started singing that song. I was in another world. I was in a trance. And after that, there was no looking back. What had happened to me was so meaningful and so powerful that I realized right then that this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to be alone. I didn't want to have, you know, two scenes in a show. I wanted to be the show. And after that, I never looked back. I just went straight forward. I put one foot in front of the other And now I wound up here with you, Terry.
And a lucky break.
I'm here with you, and I just, and this is where
the pinnacle
where
of
led.
Your career.
All that work led to you.
Now we could just have the close credits and the end theme. So how did you actually get to the bath?
Well, I was, I put together a little, a few songs. And in those days, there were many rooms in New York where you were allowed to sing, to go from club to club. You could go from club to club and you could sing three songs a night. So I had a little route that I took along with my friends, and we would go from 9th Street to 70th Street and from 70th Street over to the East Side. And you would just make these little rounds, and it, depending on what time you got there, you would get to sing your three songs. And eventually I got more than three songs. I had maybe a repertoire of maybe 10 or 12 songs. And that's what's known as, you know, an act, at least an opening act. And I sort of settled in Bud's place, Bud Friedman's place. He had a place called the Improv on 44th. And it was a mix of singers and comics. And I was one of the more popular singers at that time. And I was still taking little classes here and there at HB Studio down in the Village. And this this gentleman named Mr. Ostro called one of the teachers there and said, "Do you have anybody that can that has a little bit of an act? I need someone to come and work in my bathhouse." And the guy that he was speaking to was a teacher of mine. And he said, "Sure, I know someone," and he called me up and he said, "Look, this guy's going to call you, and you should be prepared. He needs a singer. He's willing to pay $300 a week, $300 for the two nights or whatever it was." And I said, "Where is it?" And he said, "Oh, it's in a gay bathhouse." And I said, "Oh, okay." And Stephen Ostro called me, and he told me what the situation was. And I went down, I looked at the place. I said, "Well, it looks perfectly fine to me." He had an excellent piano player, and he had an excellent drummer. And I did my, you know, we played, we rehearsed, and a week later I had opened, and there you go.
Bette Midler, her new CD is called Bathhouse Betty. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
That's it, baby. When you got it, flaunt it, flaunt it.
This is the Divine Miss Sam, and I'm here to share with you some rare and stimulating insights into my cosmic fabulosity. It's really very simple. I simply believe with all my heart. I'm beautiful. I'm beautiful. I'm beautiful, damn it. I'm beautiful. I'm beautiful. I'm beautiful, damn it. I'm beautiful. So beautiful. I'm beautiful, damn it. I'm beautiful. I'm beautiful. I'm beautiful, damn it. The way them girl they used to say, "Hey, you're too fat, baby, you can't play. Hold on, this thing, what you trying to do? You know you're too whack to be in our school.
Too whack, too smart, too fast, too fine, too loud, too tough, too divine.
Feel it don't belong.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Perseus Books, publisher of Enterprise.com, the new book on market leadership in the information age by Lotus CEO Jeff Pappas. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Jumping with my boys, sit right here in the city. Don't you know that it was grand,
really grand, so grand.
Then you came along, then you came along, boy.
Coming up, how the divine Miss M got her name, we continue our conversation with Bette Midler. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Michael Cunningham's new novel that pays tribute to Virginia Woolf.
You know you got to do some dancing to get in the mood.
Mr. Bunch will call a mom and daddy to you.
Don't be rude.
I love you, ballet.
It's up to you.
Oh, boy. I'll take you.
ba do ba do da do day.
Ba da da
ba da 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 do da do day.
Beautiful eyes, what those lips I try and possess.
Hey,
swing with me.
Ha.
What are we gonna be?
What?
May I intrude this touch dance? And I'm in the mood
to
make Dolly Liz dance.
Oh.
What a dream romance.
Ooh.
It's 3:15. There's a mess of moonlight. Cheer with me, you know.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bette Midler. Her new CD, Bathhouse Betty, features songs that remind her of the ones she sang in the 70s when she performed in a gay bathhouse in New York. Describe what the bathhouse was like and what the room was where you performed.
It was in the Ansonia Hotel, and you went down a flight of stairs, and you came to a big open room. There was a pool on one side, a dance floor on another side, a luncheonette counter, and a dressing room in the middle of the place. It was very dark. There were some lights, some bright colored lights, and to me, it was just like another club. It was a nightclub. I had played nightclubs by that time, and I loved nightclubs. Oh, I loved nightclubs. I got bitten by that bug. There's something about it. It's terribly romantic in a sleazy kind of a way. And to me, it was just another nightclub until, of course, the patrons came in. And they had no clothes on. Well, they had towels on. And that was, you know what? It's so funny because I had known gay people in Hawaii. And gay people in Hawaii are not considered anything unusual. Everybody has someone in their family who's gay, and it's just it's accepted, and no one says anything about it. And in the theater, in the community theater, we had flaming people in the theater, and I don't know, I met them, I knew them, I was there. I was just so used to it that when I was confronted with hundreds of them in towels, I guess to people who are not theatrical, it would be a stunning experience, but to me it was just the same old thing.
Now, your new CD is called Bathhouse Betty. Would you choose a song from it that, I don't know if you did any of these songs back when you were performing at the baths, or so if you could choose that song, or if not, a song that you would have sung at the baths had you still been performing there, something that you think would have gone over?
Well, I think that Laughing Matters would have been... people would have loved Laughing Matters at the baths.
Good, let's play it. This is Laughing Matters from Bette Midler's new CD, Bathhouse Betty.
Live at 5 and CNN keep us all abreast of breaking stories that contend to make us anxious and depressed. Problems with no answers hang on like some chronic cough, and every day some brand new issue rears its head to piss you off. Bad guys win. Optimism's wearing thin. Things are spinning out of control. Cynicism's all the fad. World events could make us mad. Almost every day, some underpinning slips away. These aren't laughing matters. Time bombs tick, people keep on getting sick, and a nickel's not worth.
That's Bette Midler from her new CD, Bathhouse Betty. Could you give us a sense of what your persona was like at the baths? What you wore, what kind of patter you would do in between songs, the kind of jokes you would tell?
Well, it was the 60s. the very late 60s, maybe the early 70s. I was wearing a lot of vintage clothes because I loved vintage clothes. And my hair was very long and kind of frizzy. And they always put a backlight on me so that I looked like I had a halo. And the makeup was appalling, but there was a lot of it. And I always wanted to have a sort of a sexy appearance because I thought that that was a fun thing to do. I enjoyed looking and creating that image. And you have to love the illusion. And indeed, I did fall in love with that illusion. And she was divine. As they started calling me divine, they asked me how I wanted to be introduced. And I told them the very first night, you may call me divine. Tell them I'm divine. Well, what's your name? And I had a hairdresser who was a great friend of mine. His name was, we always called him Mr. G. His name was Bill Hennessy, but he went by the name Mr. Gerard when he was in the beauty salon, and they called him Mr. G, and he used to call me Miss M, and I called him Mr. G. And so I said, tell him they had heard me, Stephen Ostrow heard me, heard Bill calling me Miss M, and so that's how it came about. He heard me, he said, Miss M, and I said, tell him I'm divine, no, the divine Miss M, and there it was, and it stayed with me. He liked saying it, and I liked being it, and so there we were.
But part of what you were making was this alter ego.
Yes, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
So you were consciously crafting an alter ego.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I still look on it as my greatest creation. I do.
How do you relate to
fabulous.
The alter ego? I mean, is
not at all. How do I relate? It depends on the day. You know, sometimes I'm mad about her, and sometimes I think, oh God, I'm so wiped out. I'm so tired. Why doesn't all this just go away? So it depends.
Now, Barry Manilow became your pianist at the Baths in, I think, 1971. I think he was your second pianist there.
Was it 71? Yeah, I guess it was. Maybe it was 70. I think it might have been 70 because he was with me for 3 years, and I think he left in 73. So I think it would be 70, no?
So he was not a known songwriter when he joined you?
Well, he was known around town as a jingle writer. I think he had a deal with Bell Records before we met. So he was known. He was known around town. He was a highly, highly respected keyboard player and also a jingle writer.
Did he give you any suggestions of songs to add or things to do on stage?
We had a wonderful time together, but we were like an old married couple. The work was absolutely fantastic, but we bickered a lot. I was very cranky with him, and I think he was very cranky with me too, only because we both had very strong ideas, and there was a lot of push and pull there. But my memory of it was that the shows were fantastic and that we pretty much had a ball. We had a wonderful time. We went so far so fast, and I think both our heads are still swimming from it, to tell you the truth.
Do you want to choose a record that you recorded with Manilow at the piano?
I must say, he did his version of Do You Want to Dance really is fabulous. I love the way he played that.
Good.
I love the way he played that.
Let's hear that.
Do you want to dance and hold my hand? Tell me you're my love man, oh baby, do you wanna dance? We could dance under the moonlight, hug and kiss all through the night, oh baby, tell me, do you wanna dance with me, baby? Do you wanna dance? Do you? Do you?
Our guest is Bette Midler. That's one of her early recordings. Now she has a new CD called Bathhouse Betty. When you moved out of the baths and started recording records and reaching a broader audience, did you...
Oh, thank God we're reaching a broader audience. I thought we'd never get out of the baths.
Did you?
I thought we were going to be in the baths for this whole interview.
Did you change your image at all or try you know, new kinds of patter or new costumes or anything different on stage, new songs?
Well, I had a little bit more money to spend, so the costumes got a little better, little better looking, but they were basically in the same bad taste, which I think was part of the charm of the whole thing. I used to say, I realized at the time that people were just breaking out of the out of their 50s thought patterns, and that bad taste actually could be a lot of fun. And so I never really actually gave that up. The patter got better. I met a lot of people. I hooked up with Bruce Valanche, who I still think is fabulous. He's a great guy. I met him in Chicago. He was writing for a Chicago paper, and he interviewed me. And we had so much fun that I asked him to write me a few lines, and he's been writing me a few lines ever since. So things did get better. I think I really did actually tone down when I got tired. I was hospitalized a couple of times in the 70s for exhaustion. And I just got so tired of being on all the time. And I said, I don't really want to do this. I would rather just be who I am and not have the stress and the anxiety of being this character all the time.
Well, I guess I'm wondering, you know, if when there is that pressure of being a character all the time, do you start to feel bad that people don't like you for who you really are? They like you.
Well, it does occur to you. Uh-huh. It does occur to you that maybe people aren't. It does occur to you. It definitely does. And even today, I'm not sure when I meet people. I always feel like I'm vaguely disappointing them because I'm smaller than they think I am. And I'm cuter than they think I am. They always say that. Oh, you're so short, and oh, you're much prettier in person. I'm saying to myself, who's lighting me that I look this bad? I look so bad that people have to tell me how much better I look in person. And I always think that I'm as I said earlier, I'm kind of a serious-minded person. I read the paper. I'm interested in the world. You know, I like nature in spite of what it did to me. You know, I mean, I'm trying to be a whole entire human being. I'm not trying to be just a caricature. So when they meet me and they want me to, you know, tell Sophie Tucker jokes or hum a few bars, I'm always appalled because I'm in show business. I get it. You're not the same. You are not that character that I saw you in that movie, you know, that you played in that movie. But I sometimes think that a lot of people think you are who, you know, you are that. And it kills me. It just kills me.
My guest is Bette Midler. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Come on along and listen to the lullaby.
My guest is Bette Midler. She has a new CD called Bathhouse Betty. You know, in some ways, the way you described your alter ego, it sounds like you saw yourself as a performance artist, you know, who kind of crafts an alter ego like that. And your husband is a performance artist, too.
Yes, he is.
So I guess is that something you felt you had in common, that sense of alter ego?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're very, very similar in temperament. We're both... we're both fairly serious-minded people, but this is a great outlet for us. You know, we get to act out. We get to be what we really aren't, you know. Come as you wish you were. You get to be all the things that you didn't get to be as a teenager, as a young kid. And it's a lot of fun. It's very therapeutic.
No, you're not exactly, though, quiet and reserved and shy around the house, are you?
Well, we have, you know what, I'll tell you something. You wouldn't want to be in our house. Our house is really chaos.
What's chaotic about it?
Oh, it's everything. Everything's chaos. Everything. Everyone's screaming at the top of their lungs. We just moved into a new apartment, and we're trying to get things to work, and they're pointing the building, and the jackhammers are going and the vacuum cleaners are running and, oh, my Lord, I need a rest. I do. I need a rest.
Now, you're a mother, too. How old's your daughter, Sophie?
My daughter's almost 12.
Wow.
Yep. People come and say to me, I cannot believe it, because I think that the idea that I had a child really affected a lot of people, or at least they remember it very vividly. I'm surprised at the number of people that remember that I had this child. And so when I tell them she's 12, they flip. They say, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. But the time really does fly. Really does. She's almost a teenager, so I have that to look forward to.
You're getting a taste of your own medicine pretty soon.
Oh, and you... Wait. What do you mean soon? How about right now? Oh, what have I made? My husband and I would just roll our eyes. Oh, Lord, it's all our fault. Oh, well.
Is being a mother what you thought it would be like?
It's better than anything I ever thought of. I had no idea it would be so great. I've had the most wonderful time. It's given me a whole new perspective, I must say.
Now, parenting isn't the kind of thing you'd think that the divine Miss M would do. The alter ego wouldn't probably have become a mother.
Well, I think actually she would have been an Auntie Mame mother.
That's right. There you go.
Yeah, yeah. But there's enough of that Auntie Mame in me. And she has had a really a wonderful time. We try to give her a little bit of the, you know, the serious side, but I'm afraid that the seriousness has not really taken root the way, you know, the hair and makeup has taken root. So I'm not sure what to do now. I'm coming into the rough years, and I think I'm just going to send her to boarding school or to a convent. What do you think?
try summer camp first.
Oh, I've tried that. That was a no-go.
I imagine that a lot of the people who you knew early in your career and some of the people who were very influential to you early in your career have passed away.
Many.
From the AIDS epidemic. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you've been very active in like fundraising causes for AIDS.
Yeah, I did. I started when I first realized how bad it was going to get, I started in the early 80s. Those benefits were mostly to raise consciousness. And I did 10 years of them, and people know what's going on. There's some slippage in the behavior areas. But there's not such a crying need, and I've sort of turned my sights to a different arena now. Since I moved to New York, I do different kind of benefits. I have a huge group that works in parks restoration in northern Manhattan. We restored the northern end of Fort Tryon. We do a lot of work in Fort Washington. We put Adopt a Highway on the West Side Highway. We have completely cleaned and maintained 120 acres in Highbridge Park, which is a park that was so dangerous, even the police wouldn't go in. And we've pulled cars, stolen cars, 5,000 tires. I mean, tons and tons of garbage out of this park. Uh-huh. And it's a great, great effort. It's been fantastic. It's been very, very rewarding.
Well, one last question. I know you have a new movie coming out soon where I think you play Jacqueline Suzanne, the novelist.
I do.
Mrs. Valley of the Dolls.
It's called, the picture is called Isn't She Great? Uh-huh. And the character is Jackie Suzanne. And it's, Jackie Suzanne was the woman who wrote Valley of the Dolls and various other novelettes. And she was a fabulous character, I must tell you. She's one of the most wonderful characters I've ever played. I really fell madly in love with her. She was very circumspect for someone who was involved in writing what people used to call trash. She was really quite refined. She never spoke of her personal life ever, and she had quite a personal life. She had cancer. Which she eventually died of. She had an autistic son who she was obliged to institutionalize, and she had lots and lots of heartbreak in her life. It was very, very interesting, and it's one of the best scripts I've ever read.
So also in this movie is Nathan Lane as
yes.
as your husband?
Yes, Nathan Lane plays my husband.
And David Hyde Pierce is?
David Hyde Pierce plays my editor. plays the editor in the piece. And he's his work is superb. And Stockard Channing is in it, too. It's a really good cast. John Cleese. There's a little bit of music in it. It's a riot. I think people are really going to enjoy it.
Well, great. Bette Midler, it's really been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
Let's hear another track from Bette Midler's new CD, Bathhouse Betty. This is My One True Friend from the film One True Thing.
And now, is it too late to say how you made my life so different in your quiet way? I can see sunlit sky and all the songs we used to sing. I have walked and I have prayed I could forgive and we could start again. In the end, you are my one true friend.
Coming up, a new novel paying tribute to Virginia Woolf. This is Fresh Air. Michael Cunningham's early novels, A Home at the End of the World and Flesh and Blood, were praised for the deft way in which they captured small details that betrayed larger emotional truths. One reviewer even compared him to Virginia Woolf. Now Cunningham steps into Woolf's shoes and her consciousness in his new novel, The Hours. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Who's amazed by Virginia Woolf? Not me, not quite yet. Oh, I know I'm the problem, not Woolf. I want to like her more than I do. I keep reading her books and even teaching them and learning about her life, waiting for that aha moment to happen. Part of my trouble stems from what most critics hail as Woolf's greatest achievement, that luminous, shimmering prose style of hers. It calls such attention to itself. I often feel when reading Woolf that she's tapping me haughtily on the shoulder and saying, "Look at that sentence I just rounded off. Isn't it elegant?" The other problem I have is with Woolf's wispy plots. Gertrude Stein once declared, dismissively, that the 19th century had invented explanation. I guess I'm more of a 19th century kind of gal. I can't help wanting Woolf to spell out more of what's happening in her books. Given that I'm not a Woolf worshiper, it's all the more a testament to Michael Cunningham's power as a writer that I was captivated by The Hours, his retelling, times three, of Mrs. Dalloway, Woolf's novel about a day in the life of a middle-aged society woman throwing a party. Cunningham clearly appreciates that novel with all the fervor I've not yet been able to muster. The prologue of The Hours announces that all intellectual irony is to be banished from this updating of Dalloway. Cunningham begins by imagining his way into Woolf's suicide on that afternoon in 1941 when Woolf, sensing herself to be sliding into another bout of madness, stuffed her coat pocket with a stone and walked into the river beyond her house. It's a well-worn image. Even those people who know nothing else about Woolf know the dramatic manner in which she died. But Cunningham, with the delicate ruthlessness of a true devotee, takes us into Wolfe's thoughts and sensations at the final moment of being. The current wraps itself around her, he writes, and takes her with such sudden, muscular force, it feels as if a strong man has risen from the bottom, grabbed her legs, and held them to his chest. It feels personal. By opening with Wolfe's suicide, Cunningham underscores just how much the themes that preoccupied Wolfe in her fiction mattered personally to her. Madness, the limited saving force of human love, the role of women in marriage, and the tension between rebellion and conformity. Those are the themes in particular that animate Mrs. Dalloway, and they reverberate throughout all three of Cunningham's Dalloway-like storylines. In one strand, he pictures another day in Wolfe's life, this time in 1923 when she's preparing for a tea party with her sister Vanessa. A second narrative follows Laura Brown, a young mother in 1940s L.A. who's beset by forbidden longings, among them the longing for free time to read Mrs. Dalloway, even as she's making a cake for her husband's birthday. And the third story concerns Clarissa Vaughn, a 50-ish Greenwich Village lesbian matron who's preparing a party to celebrate an award won by her friend Richard, a poet who's dying of AIDS. Cunningham has thoroughly internalized the lessons of his mentor. Like Wolfe, he captures and exalts stray moments of consciousness in acrobatic prose that makes their meaning manifest. In his poignant rendering of the inner lives of three female characters, Cunningham also shows that he's cultivated the androgyny of the imagination, Wolfe celebrated in her famous essay, A Room of One's Own. And yes, I know it's blasphemy, but I think Cunningham has gone Wolfe one better in The Hours by tying up his three plot lines in a self-consciously O. Henry-type twist that's as ingenious as it is affecting. That's the most striking aspect of The Hours, its emotional force. Literary remakes are usually more clever than they are moving. But Cunningham's tribute to Wolfe in The Hours is so touching, I have hopes that his feeling for her may be contagious.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Hours by Michael Cunningham. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Alan Tu, and Amy Sallet, with Monique Nazareth and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
For tapes or transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Also, Fresh Air interviews are now available online at www.audible.com/freshair.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Little Brown & Company, publisher of Blue Light, the new novel by author Walter Mosley, in bookstores, and by Columbia Legacy, whose Bob Dylan Live 1966, the Royal Albert Hall concert, documents Dylan's transformation from acoustic folk to electric rock music, available at record stores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.